From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. In a half hour, the suspected murderer of 11 congregants at a Pittsburgh synagogue faces a federal judge. He's accused of what's believed to be the deadliest attack on Jews in American history. Reported anti-Semitic hate crimes have dramatically risen nationally over the past couple of years. How do Jewish Southern Californians perceive potential hostility? We'll talk about it next.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. I hope you had a good weekend. It was certainly made much more difficult with the tragic circumstances in Pittsburgh on Saturday. Coming up, our political analysts weigh in on the disturbing developments of the past several days, including the arrest of a man suspected of mailing more than a dozen explosive devices to Democratic politicians and others. But first, the massacre of 11 congregants at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh's historically Jewish Squirrel Hill neighborhood. A 46-year-old man who lived a few miles away was arrested following a shootout with police, four of whom were seriously injured. The suspect scheduled to be taken to a federal courtroom in less than half an hour. He'd posted anti-Semitic comments on social media and allegedly made anti-Jewish remarks to police as he was being arrested. 76-year-old Barry Werber, survived by hiding in a closet at the synagogue. Afterward, he said, "I don't know why he thinks the Jews are responsible for all the ills of the world, but he's not the first, and he won't be the last. Unfortunately, that's our burden to bear. It breaks my heart." With that, I want to open up the phones for Southern California Jewish listeners of Air Talk. How you're processing this massacre of Saturday. What is your sense of life as a Jewish Angeleno? And do you sense any difference in how Jews in Southern California are treated? Have you yourself dealt with anti-Semitic incidents, or have you felt like you're pretty much insulated from that here in Southern California? I welcome your calls at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joining me is David Lehrer, who heads up Community Advocates, Inc. The purpose of the nonprofit is to bring Angelenos together to talk about important issues. But prior to that, David headed the Los Angeles chapter of the Anti-Defamation League. David, it's good to have you with us again on the program. First of all, just your thoughts coming out of this terrible event.
Well, it's clearly a tragic event, and people, innocent people, paid with their lives for the lunacy of an unstable and unhappy individual who who was clearly preoccupied with one of the most ancient of bigotries, that of anti-Semitism. We saw the fruits of what can happen when guns are available and evil thoughts pervade someone's mind. They can go in and do terribly tragic things. It's not all that difficult. And not that many years ago, almost 20 years ago, we had the North Valley Jewish Community Center here, which could have been almost as tragic. But for the grace of God, only one person died, one person too many, a postman. And the North Valley Jewish Community kids were injured, and there was serious harm done, but no one died mercifully at his target.
Which is amazing because he fired 70 rounds
oh, it was awful.
Into the community center. It's amazing that there weren't more people than the postal carrier who was killed with that white supremacist. David, what's your sense of anti-Semitism? I mean, here in Southern California, do you feel like it is worse or not?
Well, you know, the trends of the polls regarding anti-Semitism over the past several decades have all been in the positive direction. Anti-Semitism has been decreasing. Hate crimes have been decreasing. In fact, the Pew poll has done these surveys periodically the most admired religion. Turns out Jews are the most admired religious group by Protestants and Catholics and across the board. So there's a kind of strange dichotomy going on between attitudinally, most Americans are very accepting, and I think most Jews lead lives that are terribly accepting. I mean, they 40, 50 years ago, Jews couldn't work in large major industries, law firms. There was discrimination 60 years ago in admissions to universities. Those kinds of barriers have all but disappeared, and people can live where they want. The kind of restrictive covenants which existed 60 years ago don't exist anymore. But at the same time, over the past couple of years, we've had this deterioration in attitudes. We've had the sanctioning of bigotry and conspiracy theories at the highest level. And we see that the hate crimes have increased. I don't know, the attitudes have changed. And I think the major transformation has been the empowering of bigots to think that they can speak with impunity and they don't have to hide behind lurk in the shadows. Charlottesville was a perfect example. And that kind of empowering of those who should be ostracized and the feeling that they can say what's on their mind because the President of the United States says what's on his mind and invokes conspiracy theories with no basis whatsoever, I think empowers these guys who should be on the fringes to think that they're much more in the mainstream.
Well, just to push back a bit on that, isn't it, if people are thinking this way, isn't it better to hear what the lunatic ravings or hateful words to have a sense of what we're dealing with? Violence is a different thing. But if we're just talking about, you know, conspiracy theories and we're talking about demonizing certain people, is it better to keep those folks quiet or to hear those thoughts and know what you're facing?
I have no qualms about advocating that free speech entitles everybody, empowers everybody to speak. The question is, and I think American society over the past half century or so has really focused on ostracizing extremists. We learned a lesson after World War II and after the 30s with Father Coughlin and those kinds of bigots that good people in society had to speak up, had to say those are not acceptable views. Doesn't mean the views don't get expressed, but we don't have to give them a platform where they're exposed to millions of people on the air. And I think what has changed over the past couple of years is that the highest office in the land hasn't spoken up clearly and unambiguously, whether it was Charlottesville or it's advocating conspiracy notions that have no basis in fact, that Ted Cruz's father was complicit with JFK, the birther nonsense, the globalism and George Soros is funding the caravan that's coming up through Central America. I mean, those all have no basis in fact whatsoever. And yet those kinds of conspiracy notions that actually the process, the advocacy and the tolerance for conspiracy notions that have no basis in fact becomes a methodology that other people will adapt. The toxic,
so saying even it's not on the same direct subject.
Right. Exactly.
It fuels the thinking.
It fuels that kind of thinking and the illogic, and it's dangerous because for Jews in particular, we have been the subject of those kinds of bizarre conspiracy theories. The left says we're advocates of capitalism and George Soros and stuff. The funding of capitalism. The right thinks we're all George Soros and active on the left. So we can't win for losing if people are permitted to advocate those kinds of bizarre notions without data and there's no pushback, that kind of seeps into the public consciousness.
Zach in Tarzana says, being in L.A. doesn't mean we're too far away from this. My great uncle was the president of the congregation in Pittsburgh. We are all connected. These are not just 11 lives that were lost. This is added to the millions of lives before them. It is a continuation. That's Zach in Tarzana. Stu in Santa Monica says, the attack on the synagogue is not new. People often ask why synagogues have armed guards. The Saturday event is a stark reminder. That's Stu in Santa Monica. Let's talk with Yossi in downtown Los Angeles. Yossi, you're on Air Talk.
Good morning. There are so many point that the person that was on the phone before made, and you as well. You made a very good one. To summarize, this is ignorance. And if you see in the history, hate unifies people. Unfortunately, it unifies the wrong people, and ignorance fuels this kind of rhetoric that we hear today. I am so saddened by the loss of so many times I heard these stories. I'm a native Israeli, but I lived most of my life in South America, came to the States in 84. I'm a truck driver. You know, I'm not the guy that I've been made of thousands of years ago, like the person before talked about this ignorant theories about that we are controlling the world economy. Jews are poor, mid class, and rich. We're the fabric of every society. And we're being demonized in so many ways. And unfortunately, you see in history, unifies the wrong people. You made a good point. Let the ignorant talk. And perhaps in some sort of form, we can open up and say, you know what, give me your hate. Let me hear it. The base for it, somehow we can say, but we're.
Yossi, I'm sorry, we're losing your call. I appreciate it. And I love you saying, you know, I'm a truck driver, not controlling the world and the media. I do think, though, David, that part of the historic, this anti-Semitic, this hatred is a kind of jealousy. It's a kind, because in fact, Jewish culture has been extraordinarily effective in educating people, in having an influence on society. You mentioned it's the most admired group of people by religion is Judaism. And, you know, the congregant, the 76-year-old Mr. Werber, who that quote I read coming into our conversation, that's how I take this.
That is offered sometimes as an explanation. Then there was the religious basis of deicide charge, which until the Second Vatican Council was a significant generator of antisemitism over the past two millennia. You know, the poor Jews in the Ukraine who lived in shtetls weren't exactly somebody to be jealous about. They were poor and impoverished, and yet they were victims of the same kind of bigotry. It's a very complicated phenomenon. I've been studying this for most of my life. I don't know.
What is your, yeah.
It's complicated. The people, I think a lot of it has to do with people feeling their victims and looking at somebody else who can help make the world, make sense of the world to them. I'm not happy. Things aren't going my way. It's their fault. And being a victim exonerates you from moral obligations because you're the victim. You're entitled to right the world and right the world that has been unfair to you. And I think that plays a large part in antisemitism.
Yossi, I appreciate your call. Let's talk next with Marisol in Lakewood. Marisol, good to have you with us.
Hi, I am married to a man of Jewish descent, and we've raised two children that identify, we consider them patrilineal Jews. And I think it's been really important for us to raise them to identify Jewish because this is their heritage. This kind of history of pogroms and being kind of subtly under attack, that is their part of their heritage. You know, we still today face examples of what I consider benign anti-Semitism, acts of ignorance that talk about, you know, saying that Christianity came before Judaism. And I teach my children to correct these acts of benign anti-Semitism because it becomes malignant.
David, your thoughts on that? I mean, is ignorance anti-Semitism?
Well, ignorance fuels conspiracy theories. And if you're looking for a conspiracy as to why things are going wrong or the hidden hand that's making the world the way it is that you don't like, Jews are as good a target as anybody else and historically have been the target. So that fuels it. It's a very complex phenomenon. I must say, just to counter some of what the caller just said, the fact is that by most metrics in the United States, Jews are doing very well in terms of discrimination, in terms of, until the past 2 years, in terms of hate crimes, in terms of acceptance, in terms of socioeconomic success. So America has been very good to the Jews, and this is a tragic incident, which is kind of an exclamation point to say, you know, things haven't changed completely.
America's been good to the Jews, and can you imagine America without its Jewish Americans? It's just, it's unimaginable what this country would, how different it would be without.
Well, if we're up to Mr. Bowers.
All right, David Lehrer, Community Advocates, Inc., president of the nonprofit, with us. Coming up, Rob Eshman, the former editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal. You might have seen his op-ed in the Los Angeles Times yesterday, in which he shared his thoughts on the massacre on Saturday in Pittsburgh. He also teaches at SC's Annenberg School. Rob Eshman will be joining us, along with David Lehrer, and we take your calls at 866-893-KPECC. Back in 1 minute. On Air Talk. Tarek in Pasadena says anti-Semitism in right-wing nationalism isn't just a Jewish problem. It's a problem for Muslims, for all other minorities, and we need to figure out how to fight it together. Our phone lines are open for you to share your experience as a Southern Californian. Particularly Jewish Air Talk listeners, I'm interested in your thoughts at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Rob Eshman, good to have you with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Rob. So I want to start with your op-ed that you wrote for the Los Angeles Times, because you make the point that the suspected attacker here was targeting Jews for something that is a very important part of Jewish culture and concern for others.
Right. I mean, like David said, the anti-Semites have always been with us, and they always have to find in every generation a reason for their anti-Semitism, a reason for hating the Jews. And often that reason involves conspiracy. And the reason that this guy chose, and I think that you see a lot in social media, is the Jewish support for immigration. And the Jewish support for refugees. And that's been part of our history. First of all, you know, it's in our holiest texts, you know, that you should welcome the stranger because you were once a stranger. And it's something that Jewish congregations around the world believe in. And it's something that here in America we fought for. I mean, the words on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty, "Send me a wretched report," were written by a Jewish woman.
And as you look at this and compare to what is going on here in Southern California, what's your sense of how Jewish Angelenos deal with anti-Semitism? How you know, particularly as the head of the Jewish Journal, what did you hear from your readers about acts of anti-Semitism?
It's rare and it's shocking. And part of the reason it's shocking is because it's so rare. I mean, as David said, also we've been blessed in this country. This is the most Judeo-philic country in the history, you know, in the 3,000 or 4,000 year history of Judaism. Never been welcomed, never been as accepted, never had as many opportunities, never been able to contribute as much as we have in America. And I think that's especially true in Los Angeles. You know, the history of Jews in Los Angeles goes back really to 1850, 1849. The first Jews came here. They opened up shops downtown. They've been part of the fabric of the city from the very, very beginning with, you know, precious little overt anti-Semitism. And that's what makes what happened in Pittsburgh, what happened at the West Valley JCC in the 90s, what makes it so shocking, because it's so rare.
Ben in Woodland Hills says, so many discussions talk about individual rights to speech, but for me, those are not more important than protecting life. The right to free speech is not worth someone dying. I think, though, Ben, the argument that many people would make is that if you restrict free speech, that's a very slippery slope, and that ultimately many more people die from restricting free speech than do as a result of free speech. David, you want to comment on
yes,
that?
Yes, and in fact, the law does not permit you to engage in speech that is endangering someone's life or is a direct threat of violence.
Someone.
So the law does recognize that distinction. It carves out exceptions where violence is likely.
Rob, your wife is a rabbi, and you know, is your sense that there is heightened danger for Jewish Angelenos or not?
You know, I don't think so. I think the danger is that there's just heightened atmosphere of hate across the board in this country. I mean, we can't forget that the same week that those 11 Jews were killed in Pittsburgh, there were, I think, two black Americans were killed in a church in Kentucky. A guy walked in or killed in a grocery store. He tried to get into a church. He couldn't, so he walked into a grocery store. So there's a sense that there's just a growing sense of hatred that's infecting America. And it's not really about keeping people from speaking their minds freely. It's about what our leaders do to respond to this hatred. And do they foment it? Do they fan conspiracy theories, which often have lethal consequences, or do they, you know, actively seek to tamp it down and to address it?
Michelle in Studio City says, unfortunately, everyone is blaming the right and Trump. But what about people on the left? Mentions the name of someone I'm not familiar with, an MSNBC who blame all of this on Israel. I feel like anti-Israel sentiment is creating anti-Semitism. That's Michelle in Studio City. David?
Well, anti-Israel sentiment can devolve into bigotry and anti-Semitism, but Israel's a country. It does things that aren't necessarily, in everybody's view, okay. And criticism is legitimate if it's within the bounds of political discourse. But there can be extremists in the realm of discussing the Middle East that, as I said, become anti-Semitic in nature. But the reality is that what individuals say, what Louis Farrakhan says, is fairly constrained. It's within a limited ambit of influence. When the President of the United States advocates conspiracy theories and talks about birtherism or Ted Cruz's father being involved in JFK's murder and on and on and on, that ends up setting a precedent that erodes the notion of truth and data and disputation for everybody. It's not just Jews. It's all everybody who wants to talk about real issues. You know, you have an excuse to say, well, I just believe this. You don't like it, too bad. And that's dangerous. And it's dangerous when you have a guy who thinks that Jews are responsible for all the immigrants coming into this country.
But let's take in this case, the suspect apparently had posted on social media, at least, you know, I read this, I think, in The Washington Post, that, you know, he did not support President Trump. President Trump is very clear with all the positive things he said about Israel. His daughter converted to Judaism right. And married a Jewish man. Is it really fair to put this on Trump?
No.
When, you know,
I'm not suggesting that Trump is responsible. There's no causal link that I know of or that will come up, may come up, but I doubt clearly that's not Trump is not out telling people to go shoot up innocent individuals. But as Jennifer Rubin wrote this morning in The Washington Post, the toxic fumes are inhaled by violent and unstable people. And if you've got fumes out there of conspiracies, of hidden hands, which is what the president essentially says, the media's out to get him, the Democrats are out to get him, George Soros is out to get him, these hidden hands out there, then people believe that there are forces at which they don't understand, which they can't document, that affect their lives. And if you're a poor slob whose life is going wrong, You why not believe that, you know, I would be great but for these people out there who are arguing that immigrants ought to be coming into this country? It's just it's too easy. It makes life too easy. And historically, the past half century, as I said before, presidents and leaders of this country spoke up against conspiracy notions, against this kind of pernicious nonsense.
Jeffrey in Beverly Hills, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, I've carried with me a relevant life lesson from my youth. When I was in a confirmation class at my temple and the rabbi posed us the question, how would you respond if someone called you a dirty Jew? And when I brought that question home to my parents, their reply was a wise one after consideration. We've made every effort to teach you, to instill in you love of your religion. And that strength must come from within. And I think the response also anticipated one of the perverse effects of victimization, the sense of exemption from moral responsibility if you are the victim, and that you always are obligated to conduct yourself on the highest moral level you're capable of.
Jeffrey, I appreciate your call as always. Thanks very much. Rob Ashman, you want to tag on to what Jeffrey just said?
You know, I don't want to leave people with the impression that, you know, Trump is to blame for this, but I do think that we have no qualms about attacking or calling out Muslim leaders, Islamic clerics, Muslim kings, and when they inspire or foment anti-Semitism, when there's terrorist attacks that they inspire. And I think in this case, you know, our leaders have to be very, very cautious about engaging in conspiracy theories, because those are the kinds of things that, you know, create these toxic reactions in unstable people. And they are responsible to some extent.
Donald Trump said today all of America is in mourning. I should say yesterday he tweeted this, over the mass murder of Jewish Americans at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. We pray for those who perished and their loved ones, and our hearts go out to the brave police officers who sustained serious injuries. This evil anti-Semitic attack is an assault on humanity. It will take all of us working together to extract the poison of anti-Semitism from our world. We must unite to conquer hate. That's Donald Trump in his tweets following the attack on the Pittsburgh synagogue. Leora in West Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk.
So I just wanted to say that I've lived in Los Angeles almost my entire life, and I grew up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, and thank God we've been largely insulated from such incidents. But as sad to say, it wasn't completely surprising. We've always grown up and been taught that there will be people who will hate us, and sadly, it's just showing it all too much.
Leora, I appreciate the call. Thanks very much. I think, you know, here in Southern California, because they're comparatively rare incidents, when it happens, the impact is great. And it's interesting, we haven't had any callers so far have mentioned something, but we had a host here on KPCC who a number of years ago, she was an older woman, lived in the Hollywood Hills, and she had an incident where she had stopped in the street in front of a neighbor's house or someone, and a young man, you know, blew past her, unhappy with her driving, and yelled out to her, expletive Jew. And she came in and talked about it the next day, and you could still see just the astonishment and the, you know, the hurt, that here in Los Angeles, someone would say, because, you know, and I wonder, that even though it's isolated, something like that, David, can be so pointed to have that experience.
It can be searing because, mercifully, yeah, they're so unusual and people don't expect it. And people, for the most part, people are civil and tolerant, and we're accepting of the diversity that surrounds us. So when something, this kind of anomalous incident happens, people really find it jarring.
Yeah. Rob, how common do you think those sorts of, you know, conflict day to day where someone's Judaism is, you know, brought out in a negative way, how common do you think those events are?
Well, the ADL actually does a survey every year of anti-Semitic incidents, and a lot of it's been getting a lot of press lately because they said that in 2017 anti-Semitic incidents were up by 60% in the country. But when you really dig deep into the numbers, you know, the numbers are not that huge. I mean, you're talking about an increase from 1,200 incidents in this giant country to 1,900 incidents, and actual assaults actually fell by 50%. So it's not that common. I think what is more common is if I was at the federal building last night for a rally that was held in support and memory of the victims of Pittsburgh, And it was incredibly heartwarming. I mean, I think the truth of America was at that rally, because there were thousands of people. There were, of course, many Jews, but there were also Muslim speaker Aziza Hassan from Newground spoke. I was standing next to a woman minister from the Presbyterian Church who was there. There were people from all walks of life and all religions there in memory of these victims and in support of the Jewish community. And I think that's more what America is.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, thank you both.
Can
so
I just
much.
Mention, Larry,
yeah, real
one thing?
Quickly, David. Yeah.
If people are interested, on November 5th, next Monday, we're going to have a program at Stephen S. Wise Temple at Mulholland 405 with Max Boot, who's a columnist
for the
Washington Post, and your former colleague, Pat Morrison, who'll be in dialogue with him, discussing these and related issues about what's going on in America today. So 7:30 on November 5th at Stephen Wise
Temple. David Lehrer is the president of Community Advocates, Inc., the L.A.-based nonprofit. Rob Eshman, former editor-in-chief of the Jewish Journal and adjunct professor of media, food, and culture at SC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Coming up, it's our political experts. They'll join us to provide their analysis on what's been a rough several days recently here in the country. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Erdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. And it's time for our weekly conversation with our political analysts. Joining us in this segment, Pete Peterson, the Dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy and Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine. A little bit later, we'll talk with UCLA's Matt Barreto, who is Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies. But let's first listen to Vice President Pence in conversation yesterday on Meet the Press, NBC News, Vaughn Hilliard. And the vice president asked about whether President Trump's heated rhetoric and denigrating of his political foes has had an effect on violence in the country.
The president just this morning referred to a congresswoman as a wacko. He's called people low IQ. He's called people horse face, from athletes to the prime minister of Canada. I guess the question here is, have you ever asked him to please not use that type of language when referring to other people for the case of civil discourse in this country?
Look, everyone has their own style. And frankly, people on both sides of the aisle use strong language about our political differences. But I just don't think you can connect it to threats or acts of violence, Vaughn. And I don't think the American people connect it. The American people believe that those who are responsible are the people that actually conduct these threats.
Pete Peterson, Pepperdine, Dean School of Public Policy, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Your thoughts about how President Trump's rhetoric is being connected to the sending of explosives to Democrats, media, and others, and the massacre Saturday in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, Larry, great to be with you. And it really has been an amazing few days here in the United States, American history. I do believe and agree with the vice president there in the clip that you just played, that I don't see a connection between Trump's rhetoric and these actions, whether it be in the pipe bombs that were sent by SIOC or in the shooting over the weekend at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. But where I do fault the president, and I think we do have to separate Trump as president versus some of the other rhetoric we've heard on the left by those of lesser office holders, is that he's not really doing much, it appears, to bring the healing that is necessary. This is a unique role that the president has, and one that I think he could be playing better. But to answer the original question, do I see a connection between his rhetoric and this violence, I really don't. But he could be doing a lot more. And he's begun doing so. Certainly some of his comments at the rallies that he was at over the weekend, calling out the cancer that is anti-Semitism, I think is a beginning. You know, as he noted in one of his rallies over the weekend, it must be confronted and condemned everywhere it rears its ugly head. We must stand with our Jewish brothers and sisters to defeat anti-Semitism and vanquish the forces of hate. That is at least the beginning. But as soon as he gets on his so-called Twitter machine, it seems to change on a minute-by-minute basis.
Well, and the critics of the president blame him for the divisiveness in the country and say he set the tone. He's the one in not acting presidential that's then led those on the other side to respond in kind. But essentially, it's the president's fault because he's the highest office holder and he's sort of set the rules of the game. Your response to that?
Yeah, I really don't see it, Larry. I mean, that is a very convenient excuse among those on the left to excuse behavior from those on the left. Those kinds of actions, whether we're talking about Antifa, to go back even to the time before Trump was president, there have been fringes on the left that have been violent since time immemorial. I'm just going back and rereading a book by Brian Burroughs called Days of Rage, where, just to get some historical perspective, it covers the thousands of bombings by leftist organizations in the 60s and 70s. I would say that Trump could be doing a lot more to respond to this moment, but to connect these specific events to Trump's rhetoric, I just don't buy it.
We're talking with Pete Peterson. He's the dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. President Trump tweeting yesterday, or I should say today, many gang members and some very bad people are mixed into the caravan heading to our southern border. Please go back. You will not be admitted into the United States unless you go through the legal process. This is an invasion of our country, and our military is waiting for you. And it appears now that several thousand, up to 5,000 active duty troops could be deployed to the southern border to await the arrival of the caravan. Pete, does that seem like overkill to you, or do you think that that is a justified response?
Well, I would hope, and I believe this would be the position of the administration, that if word were to spread that this many troops were going down to the border, it would dissuade those who are in transit to turn around or to hold in place in Mexico. Certainly, it would not seem that it would be necessary for that many troops to be alongside all the other public safety and border patrol personnel that we have in place there, this additional sending of troops would be necessary to address this particular situation. But I think it would be hoped that that word would be apparent to those that are making their way north that the United States is going to hold seriously the integrity of its borders.
Do you think that the president threatened to just shut the border, to not consider any requests for asylum from those that are in the caravan? Do you think that's justified?
No, I don't think it's justified. But at the same time, I think that when we're looking at this amount of people, I really do go along with the thinking that that which gets rewarded gets repeated. I don't think that Trump and the administration are simply responding to this caravan. I think that there is a belief, if not a deep concern, that this could be the first of several. I certainly have read in various media reports that other similar size caravans are in the midst of developing. And so this isn't just about responding to this particular one. This is about the possibility of trying to dissuade future similar movements from happening.
Apparently, yeah, there's another caravan. There's sort of a battle over a bridge crossing in from Guatemala to Mexico, and Mexican authorities that have tried to stop the progress of that caravan. Also, before I let you go real quickly, the election of a far-right president in Brazil Angela Merkel of Germany announcing she's going to step down when her term comes to an end in 3 years. Your thoughts on those two major developments, Pete?
Well, I think it's just a continuation of what we've seen globally about the rise of outsiders versus insiders. This is a wave of populism that we've seen that cuts both left and right. In this case, it seems to be on the right, certainly in Brazil. Bolsonaro, who's being called the tropical Trump, is seen as someone who is very similar to Trump in at least some of his rhetoric. What I haven't seen, though, and this is, I think, really it's not helpful as a citizen trying to understand events, is I've seen a lot of what he's said that certainly is sexist and homophobic. But what I haven't seen about Bolsonaro are really his policies. You know, he's being called a rightist or somebody on the far right, but I haven't at least seen that as it applies to policy. So I think it remains to be seen how he will actually govern.
All right. Pete, thank you so much. As always, appreciate it. We'll look forward to talking with you next time.
Great to be with you, Larry. Thanks.
He's the Dean, Pete Peterson, Pepperdine School of Public Policy, Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute at Pepperdine. Coming up, UCLA's Matt Barreto will be joining us. We'll talk with him, get his thoughts about the developments, some deeply disturbing over the past few days. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our second hour, we're going to talk about a social media platform, Gab, very similar to Twitter, but with complete free speech on the platform. It's had to go offline because all of the support services for the platform were pulled out from under it. The platform had been used by the accused killer in the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre. We'll talk about Gab, what it does, and is there a need for a social media platform that essentially allows even extreme views to be expressed regularly. Right now, we continue our conversation on the political developments in the past several days. UCLA professor of political science and Chicano studies, Matt Barreto, is also the co-founder of Latino Decisions, the research and polling firm. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Yeah, my pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
First of all, your thoughts on how you think the president should be responding to the series of explosives sent to Democrats and others, as well as to the anti-Semitic attack Saturday.
Well, I think we need to see a much stronger response. And it's not just these two attacks, but if you really go back to what happened in Charlottesville a year ago, it's really troubling that there has not been a complete and immediate condemnation of anyone who purports to be following in some of his own rhetoric or ideology in carrying out these attacks. It has been retweeting what the vice president has said or calling both sides having some good people. And I think you're continuing to see that. And there needs to be an extremely strong rebuff, denial, and calling for an end to anything that would bring violence to anyone in this country. And we haven't seen that strong of a response yet.
So you don't think even with his comments in the wake of the anti-Semitic attack Saturday, because he's used pretty strong language to denounce that attack.
Well, I think the latest has been his strongest, certainly, but it was really on the heels of the pipe bomber who was an avowed Trump follower, and he distanced himself from those and did not involve himself as strongly as he could. And I think even on the issue of anti-Semitic attacks, we've seen others over the past few years, including attacks across the country, graffiti in New York City subways, all sorts of really troubling events, including at the Charlottesville rally where people were screaming anti-Semitic things. And there wasn't that. So in this case, in this specific case, it could be that the violence was so horrendous that he did issue that response. But I think on whole, if you look at the patterns in these attacks, going all the way back to right after the campaign when some Mexican-American men were beat and urinated on in Boston, and when they were arrested, people said they were carrying out Trump's work. We've seen this for 2 years, and there has not been a strong enough repudiation.
Matt, I also wanted to ask you about the caravan, the president threatening that there will be no consideration for anyone seeking asylum from that group when it arrives at the U.S. border. Up to 5,000 active-duty military may be sent to perform support roles along the border. Your thoughts about this?
Well, I think clearly the president is just posturing here. It's politics a week before the election. He's trying to get some of his most fervent supporters back on his message, which is an anti-immigrant message. When you look at the folks coming from Central America, we already have asylum and refugee laws in place, and people have a right to present themselves at the border and apply for or seek asylum and have a credible fear interview. And if he's going to put those laws on hold and supersede those laws, then I think the ACLU and others will come and directly challenge that. We already have a system in place. You're talking about maybe 4,000 people who are making a very slow trek towards the United States. We've already got 19,400 Border Patrol agents. He wants another 5,000 military folks to deal with these asylum seekers. I mean, I think it's complete political posturing.
We're talking with Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science. Phil in Manhattan Beach says media has to accept some responsibility for inflaming tribalism in the U.S. because media in its grab for profits is looking to shock the viewer. That's part of the business model. They define what news is and isn't, and they play this up, inflame tribalism for their bottom line. That's Phil in Manhattan Beach sharing his comments. Julian Irvine says, Trump says there were terrorists in the caravan. So to say he's innocent of this is simply not true. The president is helping to stoke many of these conspiracy theories. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Before I let you go, Professor, I also wanted to ask you about the far-right candidate's victory in the presidential election in Brazil. Pete was saying he wasn't quite sure what the policies are of the new president. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. He does have a similar campaign style to Donald Trump in that there was light on substance, but very strong on sort of strongman law and order and pushing away opponents. And so the policies will remain to be seen in Brazil. But this candidate, who is now the president-elect, really did have some very inflammatory rhetoric, not only against religious or racial and ethnic or gay and lesbian minorities in Brazil, but also against any opponents. I think that's one of the things that's very questionable about democracy is that he has made calls to lock up, to torture, to do all sorts of horrible things to the previous wave of elected officials in Brazil. And so we are seeing some similar rhetoric there. But in terms of actual public policy, what he'll do, he was very light on that on the campaign trail.
And what's your sense of the expectation, just real briefly? What are Brazilians most concerned about and hopeful that he can fix?
Well, I think, you know, Brazil has seen a spate of political corruption, really going back to the bidding over the Olympics and the World Cup and everything that has happened in the country since. There's been a lot of scandals back and forth. Administrations have fallen. And so it is a time for political stability, economic stability, but really political stability. And you really need someone who's much more of a healer right now in Brazil. And it will remain to be seen. But it does not appear that this president-elect is going to take that role as he is continuing to really use divisive language.
Matt Barreto, thank you as always. Good to talk with you today. We appreciate it.
All right, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
UCLA political scientist, professor of Chicano studies as well, co-founder of the polling and research firm Latino Decisions. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to come in our second hour. Tell you about it in a moment.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Later this hour, Ricardo Lara will be with us, candidate for state insurance commissioner, former state senator. He is the Democrat running for the position against a no-party preference candidate, Steve Poizner. We'll talk about that race coming up. And then at the end of the hour, the triple play is back together. A. Martinez, Nick Roman, and me will talk about the sad ending of the Dodgers season. Last night, the Dodgers falling 4-1 to the very strong Boston Red Sox. But right now, we turn our attention to Gab. It's a social networking site, much like Twitter, and it bills itself as a free speech alternative to Facebook and Twitter, because both of those platforms have gone beyond just removing people for actually physical threats, but because of violations of policy that they say is hate speech. But after the shooting in Pittsburgh, prior to which the suspect posted anti-Semitic comments on Gab, the hosting providers of the platform, like PayPal and the app stores, no platform Gab, meaning it could not continue to operate. Well, in an interview with NPR, Gab CEO and founder Andrew Torba defended the site, leaving up the comments by the accused Pittsburgh killer, saying the comment that was most controversial was Robert Bowers saying he was going in. Here's what the CEO said.
What would you expect us to do with a post like that? You want us to just censor anybody that says the phrase, I'm going in? Is that what you're proposing here? And here's the thing. The answer to bad speech or hate speech, however you want to define that, is more speech. And it always will be.
So the argument is that there may be hateful things on Gab, but the purpose of it is to allow all speech to take place. And the I'm going in comment, not necessarily meaning that someone's going to pick up weapons, go to a synagogue and kill 11 people. With us to talk about whether there is a need for a total free speech platform like Gab that goes beyond what Facebook or Twitter provides is Jeffrey McCall, DePauw University in Indiana, professor of communication and columnist for The Hill. Jeff, good to have you with us again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So your thoughts on this? I mean, is there a need for a place like Gab?
Well, this really raises a tough question because we really have conflicting fundamental principles here. One is we want a society where, you know, we act civil and we respect each other. But we also have in our nation now, of course, the fundamental principle of free speech as operationalized in the First Amendment. And Gab is taking the more absolutist approach to free speech. And I think maybe at some point we need to find some sort of workable in-between area between absolutism and free speech versus total censorship or oppression of speech as well. I mean, I think you could make a case that, you know, Gab is operating as a free speech platform. It suggests that all ideas are going to be there. You know, it is worth noting that Andrew Torba's response in the interview earlier that the answer to hate speech is more speech, that has been kind of a rationale for years and years about how to deal with speech we don't like. And I think that's the question here. Gab has a lot of speech we don't like. Is the answer to try to go shut it down, or is the answer to try to have more speech somehow and create a society in which maybe we don't have those kinds of hateful messages and extremist messages? So I guess I would say there is a need and a conceptual place for Gab, whether Gab in particular as a rallying place or extremist points of views is necessary is kind of a separate issue almost, because I think we can kind of look at two good things at the same time. One is we want a civil society, but two, part of that is having free speech as operationalized in the First Amendment.
Well, and I think the other thing is the value that many Americans espouse, that as terrible as certain types of speech might be, to try and encroach on that, certainly for the government, if you're talking about the First Amendment, to encroach on that is to then get in that slippery slope of what's offensive, what's harmful. Let me bring into the conversation Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute, Senior VP at Poynter and one of the nation's leading authorities on media ethics. Kelly, good to have you with us again.
Thank you.
So what are your thoughts? Is there a need for a place like Gab, which allows even hate speech?
Man, I am really torn about this because the government, the First Amendment protects the government, protects us from the government and from the need for the government to suppress our speech. But our government also requires that when you build a space, whether that's a physical space or now we're talking about a virtual space, but if you build a physical space and you control that space, you are expected to take responsibility for that space. And the First Amendment says that the government can't tell you, an individual, what you can and cannot say, but it doesn't put that requirement on other proprietors. And so in this case, you have a place that was built, and it says it was built to promote free speech, and yet it is a haven for hate speech and for white supremacy. And there's a disconnect between those two things, because it turns out that when you have too much of one kind of speech, all the other speech goes away. And so I am not certain that the framework of looking at this as a free speech issue is the right framework to look at it.
Well,
because that's a government issue.
Sure, absolutely. And I don't think anybody would say that PayPal or any of these other companies, that they don't have the right to pull the plug on supporting it. They're private companies. They say, we don't want to be associated with this kind of language. We're going to, you know, and so then it's up to Gab to find some other way to keep their platform operating. So from a legal standpoint, I think, you know, that's really not debatable, that PayPal has no obligation to keep servicing Gab. I guess my question more is there an inherent social value in even a place for terrible things to be there one way or another, that as opposed to just forcing that to go underground? Let me bring into the conversation USC law professor Jody Armour. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Good to be back with you, Mary.
So, I mean, again, on the legal issue, right, there's no way anybody could argue that these private companies have an obligation to do business with Gab.
No, they don't have – the private companies don't have an obligation, but they still raise some of the same free speech concerns that we have. I'm a regular user of Twitter, for example, and when there was a crackdown by Twitter on hate speech, there were a number of folks that followed me and who I followed back who disappeared. Even though I would consider them progressive, they were fighting the powers that be. They were Black Lives Matter activists, for example, and others whom some might characterize as black identity extremists and have, but I didn't think were being that radical extreme. But because you had a private third party coming in and saying, in the name of a more civil discourse, we're going to crack down on what we view as hate speech, what you wind up doing oftentimes is empowering decision makers to crack down on the voices of socially marginalized dissidents, socially marginalized dissenters. You know, it's going to be hard to draw a line that you can defend, Larry, between, say, someone like Ben Shapiro, who raised controversy when he came to SC a little while ago, and Jody Armour. Jody Armour is saying things from a more progressive perspective, but he's saying things that certain people find just as offensive as things that Ben Shapiro says. He's supporting Colin Kaepernick's right to the Armour is, for example, to bow down during the national anthem. And some would say, hey, well, that's disrespecting America and the troops. And so that's hate speech, and crack down on Armour and crack down on anything he has to say. So I'm concerned about giving anyone the tool to go after anyone on this.
So in your ideal, if you could make the world as you would ideally like it, would that be a Twitter that, aside from direct threats against individuals, allows essentially everything, a free-for-all? Would that be your preferred?
I just don't see where else you're going to be able to draw the line between the kind of transgressive speech that you want to protect because it is advocating on the behalf of marginalized communities and the kind of speech that you just find hateful because they don't share your political perspective. That's a slippery slope. I cannot find a stopping space. Any place you tell me to stop, I'm going to say that's arbitrary. That's a wacky wall. We're back on the slippery slope.
Kelly McBride of Poynter, your response to Professor Armour.
Well, look, it's all arbitrary, right? I mean, when you walk into a grocery store or a mall, if you start doing something that the owner of that place doesn't like, they will ask you to leave. If you go into a public park, it's quite different, right? Then you are protected by the First Amendment. In these cases, you're talking not about a public space per se, you're talking about a space that is controlled by private citizens. And those private citizens have a responsibility. And this isn't an all or nothing, right? You don't have to say yes to everything or no to everything. You can agree to monitor the speech and let police know when there is a credible threat. Which is what many of the platforms are doing these days. You can design it so that certain ideas are surfaced less often because they are morally reprehensible. You can force people in that space to encounter different ideas, or you can force them to encounter ideas that are only their own. We're talking about the responsibility of the individuals who control these spaces. And I know that there's a lot of them, right? That it's not like one guy like Mark Zuckerberg controlling Facebook, that it is a host of product engineers, but there are values behind the environment that they create. And when you create an environment with no values at all, then you get a place where all the white supremacists show up.
Well, but Professor Armour, your point is, if it was Twitter, it wouldn't all be white supremacists. The reason that Gab has become the place of white supremacists is because they were locked out of Twitter.
Oh, absolutely. And you had someone like Ice Cube performing at SC 10 years ago. I asked him, what would happen when you would sing that song, F the Police, coming straight from the underground, a young brother got it bad because I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. That's his F the Police song from NWA. When he would say that, the police would come out and arrest him for saying those transgressive words that are clearly oppositional, but they were coming from a place that was offensive to those decision makers. And I'm wary about giving any decision makers that kind of authority because they're going to crack down on the marginalized dissidents, not just on what we all agree to be hate speech.
But again,
but that's apples to oranges, because the police are the government, right? They are the ones who are supposed to protect our free speech.
I'm saying it wouldn't be
private
any
citizens.
I'm saying it wouldn't be any different even if it was USC cracking down, saying we're not going to let Ice Cube speak.
Also the government.
No, well, no, that's
no, no, that's
school.
A private school. Private school. If they said that, I would have the same problem because you would be having a chilling effect on dissident speech, oppositional speech coming from a marginalized member of a group.
But what about Kelly's point is that there, if I'm following correctly, is that there is a social responsibility here, and that Twitter or Facebook has that because it, you know, it's long-term corrosive if you are operating a site where all kinds of pernicious attitudes are espoused all the time.
Yeah, I understand the social responsibility argument, Larry, but also in my personal injury class I teach torts, one of the things we grapple with at this point in the semester, I asked them, if an evil deity approached you and said, I want to give you a great gift that's going to make life much better for much of your society, all I ask is 1,000 victims that are going to suffer these deaths, would you take the gift? And, of course, everyone gives me the side eye, looks askance at me that I could even make such an indecent proposal. No, we'd never take the gift. Then I say, distinguish that from the automobile that takes 30 to 40,000 year lives a year. And we could save all those lives just by putting governors on car engines so they couldn't go over 20 or 30 miles an hour. But we're not willing to pay that price. We as a society spend lives all the time, sometimes for lofty interests like First Amendment or Second Amendment, sometimes for very mundane ones like getting to grandma's house a little faster on Thanksgiving in our car. And that's we have to acknowledge that and make those tough choices.
That's Jody Armour, SC Professor of Law, Kelly McBride at the Poynter Institute, Jeff McCall, DePaul University. Jeff, I want to get you back into the conversation. Your thoughts about the comments you're hearing from both Jody and Kelly?
Well, really great comments, and it just shows, you know, how nuanced this whole challenge we face is. I think one of the things that's worth bringing up here is that these social media sites were basically set up as public forums to start with. And then what we had is the operation of a public forum where people came and said a lot of stuff, including stuff we didn't like then at a certain point. And then I think we started going down, and I certainly appreciate Professor Armour's point on this, we end up with a point where somebody's got to decide, well, what gets in there and what's not. And that's where I think the social media platforms generally have not been very transparent to let us know on what basis they're going to decide who gets stifled and who doesn't. And, you know, what are the issues that they're going to stifle on? And I think it is worth noting here that we're concerned today about Gab as a right-wing website where extremists show up. But also, I think it's worth noting that Professor Armour's point here is that socially marginalized dissenters from the progressive side could also feel, you know, the wrath of this kind of community censorship on social media. And that's why, at a certain point, I think we need to look and say, we need to be functionally interdependent. We might just have to live with some speech out there that we don't personally like. And it calls to mind the quote from James Madison, the crafter of the First Amendment, who said, when the First Amendment was being debated at the Constitutional Convention, he said, some degree of abuse is inseparable from the proper use of everything. And I think we need to keep looking for what is the proper use of the First Amendment, and then just roll our eyes sometimes when there might be some improper uses, but we still have that fundamental principle of free speech.
You know, I want to continue our conversation and bring listeners into it, too. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Professor McCall, I think you also just hit a really important point is that it doesn't appear very transparent what the social media platform, because I think they don't know what they really think is offensive or violates their terms and conditions. And I think that's why all their testimony that you've heard on Capitol Hill, you know, from Zuckerberg and from the others is so murky, because they don't quite know. Once you get out on that slope, it's very it's like the pornography. You know it when you see it, but then how do you set a standard in advance? We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.com. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Stephen in Hancock Park says, like others, I'm torn between protecting free speech and preventing hate speech. But looking at it from a law enforcement perspective, if we give law enforcement the opportunity to flag certain sites or people on those sites, we may be able to prevent tragic events. Professor Armour, I suspect you'd have something to say about law enforcement flagging certain people using social media to do that.
Yeah, well, Karen Bass, Congresswoman Bass, had in recent hearings has called the FBI on its black identity extremist designation and said that this is smacks of COINTELPRO. Why are you taking mere activists like Black Lives Matter folks and characterizing them as black identity extremists? That's the government coming in, exercising its discretion to consider certain people making transgressive speech that is so transgressive that they're going to crack down on it. And it's worrisome.
And again, if there's a direct threat, you'd say
that's a whole other matter. Yes, Larry, absolutely.
If it's a because that's then a public safety issue if you're talking about that. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me go back to Kelly McBride, Senior VP at the Poynter Institute. Do you think that we're just going to end up eventually with sort of balkanized social media sites that give people their own echo chamber in which to operate?
Yes. The way we're going now, definitely. You got to remember, they weren't set up to be a free marketplace of ideas. These are companies that were set up to make money, and they are beholden to their shareholders. Gab had a pro-subscription model that you could use. And so they all have a business model behind them, and the business model is not to support democracy.
Yeah, and so it's to not offend the paying users or sponsors, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you think, Professor McCall, that that's where we're going, that everybody just talks to people who share their views on the same platform?
Well, it seems like society's already heading that way, whether the platforms are there or not. So, I mean, I think, in a sense, the technology is following society in a certain way. One of the things I think's worth thinking about here, too, is If by some chance the technology world, the digital world, became successful in stifling or moving marginalized voices off into their own little corners, does that eventually solve the problem of a polarized society or a society in which hate speech, you know, lives on? Because the people who are in those camps are still going to organize, they are still going to be able to meet, they are still going to be able to send out newsletters. So I would just caution people who think if we can just shut down these websites, we'll have solved this problem. I think they need to recognize we have a much broader problem, and hate in our society needs to be addressed on multifacets and not just by trying to target websites.
Well, and my assumption is that if the extremists that are using Gab had been able to use Twitter, they probably would have been there, right? Because wouldn't their hope be to contact the largest audience possible? Jeff McCall?
Oh, yeah. So I think they probably would be there. And the fact that they got run off of there probably sends them in another direction, but maybe allows them to fuel their hate even in more severe ways.
All right. Closing comment from you, Jody Armour, professor. Do you think that Gab or something like it will probably be able to resuscitate out of this?
Well, Larry, the reason I'm so solicitous of allowing lots of free speech to live on these platforms is I saw the Black Lives Matter movement grow and burgeon thanks to Twitter. Black Twitter. And I worry about what could have happened to that movement. We made social media an important catalyst for our social movements these days. I wonder what would have happened to that movement if you had some Twitter censor filtering out a lot of that potential. So that's my concern.
All right. I want to thank you all for being with us. That's Jody Armour, USC law professor, Jeff McCall, communications professor, DePaul University, and Kelly McBride, senior VP at the Poynter Institute. You can share your comments about whether there is a societal need for a social media platform that allows all speech, even repugnant speech, to take place. The AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Coming right up, we'll talk with candidate for State Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara. We continue with our coverage of California's ballot propositions and candidate races. Joining us is candidate for California Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara. He's former Democratic State Senator from Bell Gardens and the Long Beach area as well. Thank you so much, Senator Lara, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. It's always great to be on.
So let's talk first of all about how you envision the office. If you were elected state insurance commissioner, what new policies would you bring?
Thank you, Larry. You know, before I begin, I just want to send my condolences to everybody in Pittsburgh and to our Jewish community. You know, this office for insurance commissioner here in California is one of the most important offices in the entire state. And at this time in our history, with climate-caused disasters and our healthcare under attack, you know, my priority as insurance commissioner will be to stand up to the industry and stand with all Californians now more than ever to allow them to build their lives again for those that have lost their homes and continue our fight to expand healthcare and get us to a point where we can support universal healthcare here in California.
Now, you're running against Mr. Poizner, who is a no-party preference candidate, so that makes this race a little bit of an oddity here. Differentiate yourself from him and why you think you'd be the better insurance commissioner.
Thank you. Well, you know, in our only debate with Poizner, he said his number one priority is to make insurance companies remain solvent, which is important. But he also said that homeowners who lose their insurance need to shop around. I think he's wrong. Our number one priority should be protecting consumers. As an insurance commissioner, my answer is that homeowners should always be at the forefront, and that we should make sure that we protect our consumers and our working families.
What, if any, changes would you seek to make with Covered California and the oversight of the health insurance offered through the exchange?
The one thing we should do is what I've been trying to do in the legislature is expand the Affordable Care Act to allow our immigrants to pay into the Affordable Care Act that can pay into it. Currently, they're being discriminated against for the simple fact that they are undocumented. We know that roughly in California, close to 30% of our immigrant population can pay into the Affordable Care Act. We worked on this legislation, got it up to the governor's desk, got signed. We were working with the Obama administration to make this happen and ran through this election that happened. So we had to withdraw our waiver, given the fact that the Trump administration wanted us to give them the names and information of everybody who would qualify to pay into the Affordable Care Act, not wanting to endanger any of our immigrant communities in California. I had to withdraw it. But we want to continue the push to allow our immigrants to be able to pay into the Affordable Care Act. We know that they are tend to be younger, are healthier, and are working. And the more people that we have paying into the system would allow those of us that actually need the care now to be able to access the care and be able to manage the increases in our premiums, given that we have more people in the system.
Now, your proposal, would that be revenue neutral? Would those paying in to the exchange for health insurance be covering the full cost of that, or would taxpayers be taking any of that on?
No, this is absolutely they would be able to, just like anybody else, pay into the exchange with their own money, with the current policies that we have in place and premium scheduling that we have. It would be the exact same thing. It was just allowing people who can pay into the system to pay into the system with their own money without any subsidies whatsoever.
So they wouldn't get any of the subsidies because they wouldn't be eligible?
Correct.
Okay, so they'd have to be able to absorb the full cost themselves.
Exactly, and what we've seen is roughly around 30% of California immigrants would be able to afford to pay into that system.
What do you also think about California offering more bare-bones policies? In California, there's been no backing down on having the full minimum requirements of the ACA when it began. Do you think that there would be any benefit to having some less expensive, smaller-sized plans?
I absolutely think there's a benefit to having smaller size, less expensive plans. The goal is to cover everybody. You know, we've done a great job here in California of expanding care, and we roughly have, I think, 7 to 10% of folks in California are still uninsured. And we see that these folks tend to be folks who have multiple part-time jobs, folks that are immigrants and are not able to afford any care. And so we need to figure out how do we address the uniqueness of this population. And there's no doubt that providing a more affordable option for folks would help, again, get us to ensure everybody in the state, but also give people another option so that they have a level of comfort of having some sort of insurance coverage for them and their family.
And Senator Lara, before I let you go, when it comes to fire insurance, any thoughts about that? I know in California, some of the areas have been redesignated as higher risk fire areas. That's affected in some communities' availability of insurance, not as much competition. Do you see a role for the state there?
Absolutely. You know, what I've done through the legislature this year is to make sure that we protect our homeowners who have been victims of these tremendous fires, ensuring that they don't get dropped from one day to the next in terms of their policy insurance. That gives us time so that people can reassess, rebuild their lives, and then also give the data to the Department of Insurance so that we can see where this is happening. What are the trends? And how do we avoid people just getting dropped from one day to the next while they're trying to rebuild their lives? We were able to get this legislation done this year, which gives our homeowners in fire-ravaged areas an opportunity to rebuild. Also, we need to make sure that we are holding insurance companies accountable and that they are transparent with us as we work on redefining who are now in fire-prone areas. We also have to work with our local governments to make sure we understand where we're building homes. We understand that there is a great need for housing, but we also have to make sure that we're not necessarily putting people in danger as we continue to build out in these environmentally sensitive areas.
Senator Lara, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry.
California Senator Ricardo Lara joining us on Air Talk, candidate for state insurance commissioner. He's a Democrat. He faces Steve Poizner, no party preference candidate. Poizner had been the state insurance commissioner when he was Republican early in the 2000s. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, the triple play with its postmortem of the 2018 Dodgers season. We'll talk with A. Jay and Nick right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us, along with the triple play, Nick Roman and A. Martinez. The Dodgers just a home run in the 18th inning by Max Muncy away from being swept by the Boston Red Sox in a series in which the Dodgers were not particularly competitive. Their offense largely docile, the home run hitting machine of the regular season, not there for the World Series, and a bullpen that went down in flames as well. Let me start with you and... First of all, let me ask you about Dave Roberts, the Dodger manager, who's been excoriated for his decisions, including by President Trump, probably the most agreed-upon tweet that President Trump has ever had about Dave Roberts pulling Rich Hill in Game 4. Dave Roberts, is Roberts going to come back?
Because I always think about what's your other option if you don't bring back Dave Roberts? There's a club option. The Dodgers have the option to bring Dave Roberts back for at least one more season. And I think if the Dodgers and Andrew Freeman, who's the president of baseball operations, is just judging it on how he has executed his vision, then I would say, yes, you do bring him back, because Dave Roberts has done that without throwing Andrew Freeman under the bus by saying, hey, I don't get to make decisions. He makes them for me. What are other options out there that will do that for Andrew Freeman and the Dodgers brass? Not many. But here's the thing, though, and I think we all know this. Managers hate being lame duck managers, basically having nothing security-wise past this last year that they have in front of them, and that's Dave Roberts.
Players smell it.
Yeah, smell it. They take advantage of it. They know that maybe the manager can't be the same way that he always is because he has to play a political game, so it'll be interesting to see if they do keep him, if they extend him past this one year.
Yeah, what do you think, Nick?
Well, Dave Roberts didn't make the trades. Dave Roberts didn't sign the players. Dave Roberts didn't decide who came up out of the minor leagues. He did make some in-game decisions, and although the one that gets the most attention is the one on Rich Hill, all the other ones that he made were ones that basically everyone would agree with, and they all failed. And that's not his fault. I mean, at some point, the players have to play. You know, when they pulled Rich Hill even the other night and brought in Scott Alexander, the idea was you're going to get a ground ball and get a double play and get out of this inning, and Alexander's the guy who threw four pitches outside the zone, and then he went out. They got an out from Madsen, and then Madsen did what Madsen does, which is let the guys that are on base score. And, I guess some of that's on Dave Roberts, but, you know, for him to take the blame and lose a job would be stunning, and it would be stupid.
Well, okay, but Roberts acted as though he had a good bullpen. I mean, the way he behaved as though he had been given by management a competent bullpen, mm-hmm. and he really hadn't been.
Well, it showed up in Milwaukee that the bullpen was actually pretty good. But they also, and A and I were talking about this, that night before in 18 innings, that bullpen actually did quite a good job. And they exhausted them. And the Red Sox, it's not like this was an insignificant team. It's not like you lost to San Diego, you know, somebody that...
Although this Dodger team looked like they might have lost to San Diego.
They might have lost, yeah. I mean, the Red Sox had an outstanding approach. They had a lot of tough guys throughout. And they did to the Dodgers what they had also done to the Houston Astros, who won 100 games, and to the New York Yankees,
who was the best team in baseball, and they went through the Astros like nothing.
Right, yeah. So, in each of those series, the Red Sox lost one game and then pounded the other team in all the other games. In fact, you know, in some ways, the Dodgers were fairly competitive in two other games had they, pitched a little bit, pitched better. So I don't see there's some of it that's Dave Roberts' fault, because everybody's got some fault, but I would expect that he would be back.
That Friday night game, and this is Nick and I were talking about this. So while Los Angeles is thrilled when Max Muncy's fly ball became a home run and they win that game, and Twitter's blowing up, everyone's saying, we're back in it, the pessimistic side of me, of course, took over because I'm thinking, wow, it takes 18 innings and almost 8 hours for the Dodgers to finally break through against the Red Sox. That, to me, was the biggest indicator of how different the talent level was between the Red Sox and Dodgers.
And then, it made Roberts' decision the next day even more inexplicable, because I didn't realize that Pedro Baez had to be on the shelf for that game.
I didn't know that either.
He didn't
either.
Say that till after the game. Mm-hmm. And there was one other.
Urias.
And Urias. So both those guys, who I thought were both available, mm-hmm. well, then that explains Scott Alexander, among other things. So that really makes it a head-scratcher that he doesn't leave Rich Hill in the game when two of his guys who've been most successful can't come in.
Yeah, but okay, but even if you go through that, and even if the decision isn't made and the Dodgers end up winning that game, they still get pounded last night, and there's no guarantee that they go to Boston and do anything. So, I mean, this team was probably headed to the same place no matter what.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't want one, you know, really bad inning to take out Dave Roberts.
All right. Nick Roman, A. Martinez, I'd like to hear from you. If you're a Dodgers fan, what do you think comes next for this team? Leadership, trades, free agency. What would you like to see the Dodgers do to retool to prepare for the 2019 season? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Manny Machado, of course, showed his talent throughout the course of the season, but also turned in some head-scratching stuff, not running hard to first base, being lackadaisical at times. Do you think if there was any chance whatsoever the Dodgers would try and sign him, that removed that possibility?
No, and I think they've made it clear that they were hoping that he would play well enough to run his value up so that he would move on somewhere else. They've got Corey Seager, who is going to recover and be their shortstop again next season. He was truly a rental for the Dodgers in hopes of parlaying him wanting to run up his value into a great postseason. It did not work out that way. It's not going to cost Manny Machado any money. He's still a 40 home run shortstop, so he's going to be very rich. But you got to wonder, in the postseason, he's got a lot to make up for as well.
Yeah, and as I was driving home on Friday night, after I watched two hours of the game here at the station, and then another hour and a half at a restaurant, and then another hour listening on the way home, listening to the ESPN radio broadcast, and they asked Buster Olney, who follows all this stuff real closely, and where do you think Machado's going? And without a beat, he says Philadelphia,
because
they've got the money and they
lots of money
and they've got and they want him. And the Dodgers aren't going to compete with that kind of money, not when they also have to make other decisions about other free agents. And I'll tell you, for a rental, the cost wasn't that much, and the payoff was a second trip to the World Series. That's a pretty good rental.
Yeah. No, and it made so much sense because Seager's out for the year because of his dual surgery. So, yeah, I mean, it was a very sharp move.
I will say this, that it did point out that the Dodgers do need somebody who is a pretty solid right-hand batter, because they are so heavily left-handed, and even when Seager comes back, he's a left-hand hitter.
Well, Yasiel Puig's a free agent.
Yeah, well.
Is he?
Yes, he is. Do you bring him back or not?
Definitely, you have to bring him back. I'd say, you know, that weekend in St. Louis where he pounded all the home runs, the big home run that he hit against Milwaukee in Game 7, and then the home run that he hit on Saturday night that should have won that ball game. Mm-hmm. He was he's a fabulous outfielder. Everybody knows that. And he brings a lot of emotion to the team. I would say you have to bring him back. Because where else do you get a guy like that? Who else do you have who can fill that role?
Well, no one is a free agent out there. Yasmani Grandal, also a free agent. Do you bring him back?
Him, no. There are other options, younger options, more cost-controlled options in the Dodgers system that they can get away with sticking behind the plate. So I do not bring him back.
And the catcher that you're talking about is
Farmer.
It's a kid named Keibert Ruiz.
Who
has played at Tulsa this year. He was so-so for as a hitter halfway through the season, and then he caught fire. hit about 3-something, 330 the rest of the way, over close to 400 in the playoffs for Tulsa. He's really good.
They've been talking about him for 2 years.
Yeah, he's like 20 years old.
All right. We'll continue with the triple play. Amy Martinez, Nick Roman, yours truly, Larry Mantle. Our phone lines are open. What do you want to see the Dodgers do between now and the start of spring training next February? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. Skyler writes on the Air Talk page, KPECC.org, Dodgers overachieved on a rebuilding, quote-unquote, year to get under the luxury tax. I hope they reload with more elite pitching and a new catcher for next season. That's Skyler writing on the Air Talk page, 866-893-KPECC. Let's talk with David in Chino. You're on Air Talk.
Hello, Larry. This is David.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out that it clearly shows, if you look at the videotape, that when Roberts went out to the hill, Hill actually just gave him the ball. I believe Roberts was just going to ask him how he was doing.
But my understanding was that Hill, I thought, now maybe this was someone else who said it, but when Roberts comes out, that's usually to make a change. So Hill just assumed he was being taken out, handed him the ball just to show, you know, he's supportive of his manager, not because he felt the need to come back. Hey, what was your understanding?
That's how it always works. When the manager comes out, that's when you know that you're getting the hook. The pitching coach comes out to say, hey, how you feeling? Let's work on the strategy for the next guy. But when the manager comes out, the hook's coming with him.
Yeah.
And to be safe, what the Dodgers should do now, from now on, is send out the pitching coach first.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and all Roberts had to do when he's handed the ball is say, you're done. Just confirm you're not able to continue.
Yeah, and so if there was some sort of mistake in communication there, that's on both of them. They got to fix that kind of thing.
All right, David, appreciate it. Who are the five members of the starting rotation next year?
Okay, I'll take a shot at this. Walker Buehler.
I think he's safe.
You think he'll
he's
make
safe,
it?
Yeah. I think Rich Hill is under contract, so he's there. They have to make a decision about Hinjin Ryu, so I'm not sure.
Because he's a free agent.
I would probably bring him back.
And certainly we will know in about 3 days what Clayton Kershaw decides. If he comes back, then he's in the rotation for sure.
But you were saying earlier you thought he was not going to opt out.
Well, I don't think he's going to opt out, but until he actually says it, I mean, he's got the option there. So I would assume that he's coming back.
But they're talking about it. He wants some kind of extension where – so he's owed $65 million for the next 2 years if he does nothing. But he's hoping to create a deal where he has maybe 2 more years tacked on, so a total of 4 years. I would not do that in a million years for a 31-year-old with a bad back.
Actually, I would do it because I think that you have options, and my craziest option is, boy, he's a pretty good relief pitcher. I mean, would you have – I mean, Kenley Jansen has been awfully shaky. I don't know.
So you mean if his back couldn't hold up to six, seven
to
innings?
To six, 7 innings, maybe it can hold up for 12 or 14
I'm a clean
pitches.
Break kind of guy.
Yeah. So,
get rid of him while you can.
No, I think that you have to bring him back. The question is, is Ross Stripling okay, and can he return to being a starting pitcher? How close is a kid named Dustin May, who is coming up through the minor leagues?
Maeda, too. We forgot about him.
Kenton Maeda, who is still around, because I think the Dodgers are going to really have to look at, they like to have 10 guys available just for what has happened. And, I'll just sort of do, sort of a hashtag, look at the Angels, what happened. They thought they had an entire staff and they lost it all. And then the last guy, and I really hope that they get this guy, is a player out of Japan named Yusei Kikuchi, who is very, very good pitcher, and he got an okay to come to the U.S. He is really good, and I think that, and they've been scouting him for many years before, he started his career in Japan, so they know who he is.
He's not too old?
No, he's not, and I think Hershiser actually was back in Japan and took a look at him, so I think they're going to make a run at him as well.
All right. And Ferguson, do you think he makes the starting rotation?
Well, I sure liked him as a relief
Caleb
pitcher.
Ferguson,
he sure looked good as a relief pitcher. And, You sort of wish that he had been on that World Series roster. I understand why they didn't put him on. Actually, I don't.
But Urias might be in the rotation, too. He came up as a starter.
Yeah. Julio Urias. Yeah, he really, I thought he was terrific in the playoffs. And I was surprised that they put him on, and he looked pretty good.
All right. Do the Dodgers go after big name hitters in free agency? No. Specifically,
they're getting back is the guy they lost, and that's Corey Seager. That's who their big hitter is.
You don't go after Harper. No.
Well, because the Phillies also are thinking about offering Machado and Harper gigantic. They have that kind of money, Larry, to spend this offseason, and they probably will get them.
Are they paying anybody else? Or?
Everyone else is young and cost-controlled, so they have the bulk of that money to spend.
It's all right. There. They're like Alex... Scrooge McDuck sitting on that big pile of gold.
So you'd re-sign Ryu. Is Wood done? What's happened to Alex Wood? He looks like he has no confidence.
He might be better off somewhere else. Change of scenery, and I think the Dodgers probably wouldn't mind to see him go either.
All right. Frank in Pasadena, your thoughts on the Dodgers' end of the year?
Yeah, just a lot of credit here isn't given to Alex Cora. Alex Cora managed an amazing team this year. Former Dodger, I give him all the respect in the world for what he did with that Boston Red Sox team.
Well, and he was one of the guys when he was with the Dodgers. I remember everybody, boy, Alex Cora is sure smart. He's being a great manager. He's sure a smart guy.
The one thing, when he brought in his closer, Craig Kimbrell, in that Saturday game, and it didn't seem like Kimbrell had much, I thought that's Cora's first mistake. It worked out.
Yeah, of course.
But that's, you know, when you're making all these decisions that turn out to be golden, nothing you do is wrong.
Plus, he was also given a really, really good team to work with. And the interesting thing to me is that two teams in particular, the Yankees and the Red Sox, both went to former ESPN commentators as their managers, although Cora did spend a year on the bench with Houston. Yeah, Alex Cora is a great guy, and he's a really good manager.
Frank, you also wanted to say something about a breakdown between management and players?
Definitely, Larry. There seemed to be a disconnect about halfway through the year between the front and back office. I know bringing in Manny Machado was something that every sports commentator wanted to say, and you know the Dodgers finally pulled the trigger. But with Corey Seager coming back and us realigning that infield rotation, it'll be interesting to see what happens with him. And quite honestly, I really felt as though things weren't clicking all the way through the playoffs with Machado there. I know people want to say that he brought a lot of stability to some of the positions, but in reality, him in the lineup was just so inconsistent that you couldn't tell which Machado was going to be playing for us that day.
Frank, I appreciate your call.
Don't have to worry about that next year.
All right. Thanks very much. And Julie writes on the page, can the Dodgers hire Mr. Eovaldi? Well, we had him.
We had him.
We had him and traded him for Hanley Ramirez.
Yeah.
So that's a sad luck because, man, he looked great. He's had two Tommy John surgeries, hasn't he?
He's still throwing 100, though.
Yeah, he must have a metal arm at this point. All right. Gentlemen, thanks very much. It's sure been fun this season. We'll come back and do it in February.
There you go.
Absolutely.
All right. Sounds good. We'll reconvene the triple play when pitchers and catchers report, and we'll get that spring fever going. A. Martinez, Nick Roman, Larry Mantle. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up next from all of us. Have a great afternoon.